Well, despite that beautiful introduction, I'm not terribly happy to be here today. I'll tell you why. Not because I don't want to be with you, but because, first of all, I'm Mildred. I'm from Toronto. My dry date is May the 18th, 1973. And I have a home group, and come and visit us sometime if you're in Toronto. So that's the statistics you'll get. Hi. Speaking is always an interesting experience. I remember when I was first invited to speak, I always felt, oh my goodness, they want me, I'm somebody, and it was always an exciting business, wasn't it, Bob? And now, after years and years and years of doing it, it takes on a different tone. And it takes on a different tone because you've grown, you know some things, and you get the surprise of life. I was here this morning, and I heard James speak, and then I heard Jane speak. And I started to shake. And I went back to my room. You know, there's one thing you will get from me, and that is the truth. I started to shake. And I thought, I can't go back. This Jane, she's got such an exciting life and such an exciting recovery and so on, and I'm nothing. You know who knew that? I knew that when I was 5 years old. That's the old message that took over with me. Everybody else is doing exciting stuff, and me, I'm nothing. Nobody sees me. I'm not important. And I'm not kidding. When that message comes up, you see, and I learned that when there is something that needs to be healed in me, somebody comes along who has the right energy to resonate that in me. And there it was. And I thought, I can't do it. I'm going to find Dick and tell him I'm sick. I can't do it. But when you're 49 years sober, you also have something else going for you. You have some strength. You have the experience of grace that enables you to say, I can do that. I will do that, God, if you want me to. Because that's what I did this morning, as James said. He does. I said to God, this is the day that you have made and you have given me life, and I will share, I will do what it is that you want me to do. And I have learned that it's not because it's me speaking, but I believe what St. Francis knew, that he was to be an instrument. And I never know who's going to say something that's going to shake me and shape me into the being that I'm supposed to be. And so I have to believe that's not because of me, because any message that comes from me follows the same. It's the message from above. If I have learned anything in my years here, in my experience of life, it is that this is about the power. This is about God. This isn't about being nice people. It is through that. Of course it is. I'm not saying that. But that's not my ultimate purpose. I used to think that I was a human being in the process of becoming spiritual. And I don't believe that anymore. I believe today I am indeed a spiritual being right today, in the process of learning how to be a good human being. That's a different deal altogether, would you say? So, when I went back to my room shaking, I said, okay, if you believe that, then act accordingly. Then just calm down, meditate, have a drink of water. The old ways die hard. And go and do your thing. And I thought, why in the world would I ever ask to speak at 6 and 7, especially if you knew you were going to follow Jane? Oh, my God. Well, I'm going to read you something from the 12 and 12. You know, it strikes me, the difference between the way steps 6 and 7 are written in the big book and the comments on them 12, 25 years later in the 12 and 12. You'd never know you're talking about the same thing. So here's your fifth step, and you saw some nasty things about yourself. They're objectionable, you want to be rid of them, And if you resist a little bit, you ask God, and then you say your seventh step prayer, and then the book says, and now you have completed step 7. 49 years later, I'm on step 7. And what's the word it starts with? It starts with the word humbly. Humbly. I've heard more talk about humility. You know, people have written books about humility and all kinds of things. Sometimes I think we miss what the ancient, and some of them were mystics, that they knew, and they said it simply. You know what St. Bernard of Clairvaux, about 1,700 years ago, said? He said, humility is the truth. Period. Simple. Don't need to have 1,500 books at Amazon to explain what humility is. It's the truth. What I have learned is the truth is that I live in this body. You know, Sandy Beach took me aside. I've had some really good teachers. Sandy was one of them. He took a liking to me, and when I was about 3 years sober, he took me aside and he said, you know, I don't think anybody has ever taught you this. I said, what? He said that you come in a two-in-one package. And he said that two-in-one package is your body and it is your soul. And the way we're raised, we spend all our time on the body. Think about it. Isn't that the truth? And then along comes Carl Jung, sometime within the last 100 years, talking about the change that comes about where our first part of our life, we build this container, this body, this human life, and then we find out that's not it. That's not what I'm here for. And then we start the process of becoming the statesman, becoming the elder, becoming operating from the spirit. That has helped me a great deal. And then, of course, there's Tom Ivester. He was another one of my teachers. He took me aside again when I was about 3 years sober. And he said, because he knew that I wanted nothing to do with G.O.D., despite the fact that I was 3 years sober and an ex-nun on top of it. And he said, you know, I have found the power of good. I didn't know who Tom was at that time. And he explained to me that he had killed two people in a vehicular accident and that he had gone to penitentiary and that in penitentiary he found AA. Because he said there was a little man there who was on fire. That was his word. And I caught the fire. And he said, I who had always blamed the world for who I was, I went to my cell and I wrote my fourth step. And he said, I saw who the problem was. It was myself. And my life changed. And he got out of penitentiary early. And we used to laugh. He used to tease me because he swept the streets of Flint, Michigan. When I was in my year on Skid Row, I swept a factory floor. So we were the two sweepers. And he said, what I found is the power of good. And I still remember him going like this. He said, I have found the power of good. And it has taken me places I never could have imagined I would become. And he went on to explain to me that he had become a warden. How does an ex-penitentiary inmate become a warden? And he said, that is the power of good. And if you stick this with this and I could hear that. If he had said, I found the power of God, I would have shut him out because God and I weren't friends at that time. But when he said the power of good, and it is really how I see God today, it is the power of good. And therefore, I stopped shaking and I asked the power of good to make it possible for me to come and share what steps 6 and 7 have meant for me. I'd just like to read to you a little portion from, this is 12 and 12 on step 7. And he says here, for just as long as we were convinced that we could live exclusively by our own individual strength and intelligence, for just that long was a working faith in a higher power impossible. Pretty powerful statement. Goes on to say, this was even true if we believed there was a power that existed. We could actually have earnest religious beliefs which remained barren because we were still trying to play God ourselves. That's in step 7. As long as we place self-reliance first, a genuine reliance upon a higher power was out of the question. For a lot of my life, I placed high self-reliance because I didn't believe that that power was going to do anything for me. I won't go into my story. I told that the other night, but I will say this, that I lost some of, I always have loved the stars, loved the sky, loved the sunset, the aurora borealis, the moon makes me crazy, and I love it all. And I was Roman Catholic, and so I learned that there was this power, this God that created it. And then when I needed God to do something for me, he didn't. And he became kind of a useless twit to me. What's the use? What's the use of having all this power if you don't use it? All I wanted was him to change a person. And I came at that time to realize that, as I look back now, I wanted the world to be different than it was. And my sister cried, my retarded sister, and I cried with her, and I was determined that had to stop. And so I was an unhappy child. I had a good childhood. You know, my brothers and sisters were good to me. They just couldn't do what I wanted them to do, which some days I want right now. I want you to be different. I want situations to be different, and I'm unhappy when it doesn't happen. So I took a drink at 5, and the drink was the solution. Not the right solution, but it was the solution. Dr. Silkworth says, we are restless, irritable, and discontent until we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort that come from taking a few drinks. You know, isn't it amazing that St. Augustine, about 1700 years ago, kind of said the same thing. He said, thou hast made us for thyself, O God, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. Very kind of the same idea. So, I better take some of my notes. I'm still a little rattled from my experience at noon. So thanks, Jane. But I'll tell you one thing, you will get a truth out of me. I don't like standing here and saying I left the conference room and was rattled. But you know, sometimes I think we learn more from the raw truth than we do from all kinds of beautiful stories. And on May the 20th, 1973, I had a spiritual experience. By that time, if you don't know me, I had been drinking since I was 5. I had spent 15 years in a convent. That didn't work. I left the convent into a lot of psych wards and all kinds, because I was always in trouble. I was always drunk. I couldn't live without alcohol. And so I wound up marrying my psychiatrist, which wasn't smart. And we lost everything, and I wound up on a park bench. The next time you walk downtown and you see somebody on a park bench, that could have been me. That was me for a while. The police picked me off that park bench, took me to a psych ward, and the morning of May the 18th, that happened. On the 20th, the nurse told me they were discharging me, and that was not good news. I had no home. I had no money. I had no friends. My family would not allow me home the way I was, and I had no idea what to do. And I did an inventory. I took an inventory, and what I found was that I don't know how to live. You know, later on in the 12 and 12, Bill says, why is it that if God can remove the compulsion to drink, why doesn't he remove our character defects the same way? And I think it's common sense. Because the statement, he says, having been granted a perfect release from alcoholism, why are we not able to achieve by the same means a perfect release from every other difficulty and defect? Why not? But the word, the phrase that gets me is by the same means. What was the means by which God was able to free you? I know what the means was with me. It wasn't, I don't believe in a God that one morning gets up and says, hey, I think it's Ralph's day today. And so Ralph gets sober, or it's Leslie's. I don't believe that. That would make of God a tyrant. In Toronto, for example, we hear people, they get sober, you go downtown and somebody died of alcoholism or an overdose. How come? Is this just an arbitrary thing, or do we have something to... I had something to do with this. I've heard people say sometimes at a meeting, I had nothing to do with getting sober. Then I don't believe you would be sober, because I don't believe God is a tyrant. I believe God does through us what he does for us. And that's why 6 and 7 become so important, because we get sober, and somebody takes us through the steps, and then we're left with life. You know, I brought a tool basket with me when I came in. That tool basket had been fashioned by the false self, and the tools in it were all the tools of the false self. Anger, resistance, judgment, hatred, flattery, lying, cheating. All that good stuff, that's what I brought in. And so once the compulsion was taken, that wasn't taken. What I had resisted was, I don't know how to live. And that's what happened that morning when the nurse said, we're going to discharge you. I had no place to go, and I had no idea, because I was raised in a family where you didn't even think about being on the street. And then I was in a convent, and you sure didn't think about being on the street there either. You lived a vow of poverty, but you had everything you needed. And now I don't know what to do. And so I wound up on Skid Row with all my beautiful tools, all the tools of the false self. You know, I think that for anybody that has problems, it's my idea. Take a look at what step 3 says about the false self. If you wonder why you are the way you are, why you have the problems you have, I just love it. I read it almost every day, at least once a week. Because in there he says the root of the problem, I always thought it was the church. There's a good one. Maybe it was Mother Superior. Maybe it was her. Maybe it was anybody. Things that had gone wrong. If you were different, then I wouldn't be in the mess I'm in. And that's the way I thought. What does step 3 say? It's clear and it's brutal. It's brutal. It says we had to be rid of self or it kills us. I didn't make that up. God makes that possible. Why? Because the false self is just that. It's the opposite of the goodness that comes through Creator. And that's what we're here, get rid of this and live by that. But I didn't really understand that when I got to the end of my step 5. And I was confronted with step 6, which says, you know, if you got anything objectionable, you know, do you want to be rid of it? Why, of course. Of course I want to be rid of the objectionable. But I didn't understand what was objectionable. I thought that you were the objectionable portion. And the way you dealt with me, that was the objectionable portion. But then he goes on to say, and he said, if you resist, then he said, we ask God to help us be willing. You know what I have found in my life? The stuff that gets in my way has a certain push to it. It has a power to it. It has a voice to it. And it tells me something that is false, because that's the way I was raised. So, and then as we go along, he says, when ready, we say this: my Creator, I'm now willing you should have all of me, good and bad. Oh, I like that. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. I like that very much too. So, grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. And we have then completed step 7. Honey, you just began. You just began the process. So, what was my experience? Well, I was raised as a Catholic. And then I went to a convent thinking maybe God would fix a life that I didn't like, that wasn't going my way. You know, nowadays, they would take the likes of me, they would smell me, and I'd be gone. I was drunk the night I entered, and I stayed drunk while I was in the convent. You know, some people think that's an impossibility. I know it isn't, because I did it. You know, and I said the other night, we see what we expect to see. I was at a lecture not too long ago, and they showed this video where there were people dressed in white, and on this side there were people dressed in black, and there was a ball. And the instructions to the audience was that you on that side, you find out how many times the people in white threw the ball to the other side, and the people over here, you find out how many times the people in black threw the ball to the other side. And they did that. And this side had their number, and this side had their number. And at the end of this, the teacher said, now, how many of you saw the gorilla walking around in between? Not one had seen the gorilla. You know, this isn't some made-up story. I watched that thing on television. I didn't see the gorilla. I was busy counting. And, you know, the conclusion they came to is, we see what we expect to see. That's how I stayed in a convent for 15 years, as an educator, as a musician, as doing all kinds of things. And nobody really ever, not really ever, nobody ever said anything. And what happens then? The false self gets stronger. The old ideas get stronger. And you don't even know I was in a convent. We did all kinds of spiritual work. We did all kinds of spiritual studies and so on. What did I hear? I heard from what was going on inside me. The world out there's the problem. How can we change that? And I was busy trying to change you when all along I was dying inside. And then I got a Mother Superior who was enlightened, and we got my dispensation, because you can't just walk out like that. And so here I am. I was no longer Sister Mary Eugenia. I was no longer in the habit. I was dispensed from the vows, had played around with them anyway as necessary. And I thought I was good to go. I'm going out now, and I'm smart, I'm educated, I've got this, I've got that. I'm 2 days later, I find myself in the bars. And the men loved me, and I loved the men. And, 3 months later, I'm in jail. So I did go to jail, but not for very long. And I made such a fuss, the chief of police was in the jail that day, and he came down. And he had a document about this size written with the things I had done, and they were pretty shocking. And I still remember him standing over me yelling. He said, "What's wrong with you?" He said, "In all my days as a chief of police," he said, "I have never seen an ex-nun in jail." And he said, "I had better never ever see you here again." What's wrong with me? I don't know. I remember the days I took vows. I was dressed all in white. The organ was playing. The sun was shining. The choir was singing Magnificat Anima Mea Dominum, which means my soul magnifies the Lord and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior. And I meant the vows I took, and 3 days later I was drunk. So that gives you some idea. And I went from bad to worse, and I'm not going to go into all that to say, if you weren't here the other night, I've been locked up 32 times in psych wards. I've had hundreds of hours of therapy. I have had 38 electroshock treatments, and I married my own psychiatrist. And despite it all, I wound up on a park bench with nothing. And I was on that park bench, just as you can imagine, for two months, and then the police took me to the psych ward and had the spiritual experience. It's all very dramatic. 1 minute, I'm the person I have described. The next minute, I'm free of the compulsion. And I remember standing there saying, "What has happened? Did I think that was God? Today I do. Today I believe that was what you talked about, Jane. Grace. The action of God when we allow it in. How could it get into me?" It got into me because I had done an inventory of my life. I looked out at the world and everybody seemed to have it going. I didn't. I didn't seem to be able to do it. I had no home, no money, no nothing, as I've described. And so I said, "That's it. I do not know how to live. Haven't got a clue. I'm out of here. I'm going to take my life." And I asked the nurse to get my coat. And while she went to get a coat, I had a spiritual experience. You see, did I have a part in that? I don't have a part in creating grace, but I have a part in letting it in, and I have a part today in letting it in. I think the room is filled with God. It's filled, therefore, with grace, which I believe is God's activity, and it's always available if I will let it in. So I said, "I don't know how to live sober. You'll have to send me somebody." And there was a rap on the door, and a man stood there, and through that I got to a treatment center. 1973, there were no treatment centers in Toronto, but there was a hospital run by Dr. Bell, and that's where he took me the next day, and from that I went to Skid Row, and I lived on Skid Row for a year. In the six-month period there, somebody invited me to a meeting, and I went. I didn't know it was an AA meeting. And I fell in love. I fell in love with AA. And they said, keep coming back. That's how I got here. And so they said, keep coming back. And there were two men stepped forward eventually because my first sponsor got drunk. And they said, you are too sick to stay here. You have to do the steps. And they took me through the steps. Now, they didn't have the dictionaries out, and I'm not against that, but there's a simple way. I think the steps are the appeal to the heart, and that's a very simple process. They read to me. They told me what to do. I was open. I did what they told me, and I stayed. And then I had done my step in that process. I did the steps, and then I went and did my five with a priest. I did that because I had been in big trouble with the Catholic Church. I had stolen considerably from the Catholic Church. Wasn't sure how I was going to make amends and all that kind of stuff. So instead of my sponsor, I went to a Catholic priest. And he took me. He was very understanding and all of that. And I remember the uplift I had. And I went home and I did 6 and 7, as the book instructs me to. And I was sure I would be perfect thereafter. No more of the old ideas. Not so. I had to start living. I got out of the factory where I swept the floor. The God shot started. And that's when you have to start dealing with people. That's where you have to start dealing with life the way it is. And I had no clue about how to do that. Because when you start drinking at 5 and you keep on drinking at 5, you don't learn much about relationship and how to do things the right way. So by the time I did the best I could. Let's put it that way. And if you knew me at that time, you would say I was a good member of AA. I went to my meetings. I had a sponsor. I sponsored people and all. The problem was I didn't have a relationship with God. No relationship with God. And that colors everything. But the thing that I understand today is this. God always meets me where I am. He doesn't meet me where somebody else is and says, you should be there. You're wrong. That isn't how it goes. I've always had that power, some goodness come along that gives me the information or the lesson. Sometimes it's a hard lesson, but it gives me whatever. So what happened to me in the first 21 years, I spent the first 21 years, I did not pray. I could talk God. Nobody realized what was going on in me. Don't forget, I was in a convent 15 years. I studied theology. I read all kinds of books. I could talk God with the best of you. And I did. I didn't really understand that I had no relationship with God. And then I became very successful. I got my job as an educator. And then the God shots happened, and I bought houses, and I even built my own house. And life was, I was right on top of everything. And dying inside, you see. Step 6 is there for a purpose. And you see, I think that's when we get to see what's really going on inside. When we take on life. And when I took on life, as long as I was okay buying houses and all of the things I was doing, I didn't feel that. But once 18 years came along, I one day was confronted with something from the big book. That statement, the day will come when faced by a self-imposed crisis, you will have to make a decision. Either God is everything or nothing. I remember I almost drove the car in the ditch. What am I going to do? Do I believe God is nothing? Well, I don't know. Do I believe it's everything? Eh? I don't know. But I think it's safer to say it's everything than nothing. So that's what I took on. Be careful what you say, because that power heard me. And it started to teach me stuff. And I started to realize I was in big trouble. And so at 21 years, I'm suicidal. And I decided that I'm going to take my life. And again, God met me where I was, not where I should be or could be or whatever you want to say. God met me. And a speaker came to one of our meetings, and he talked about how childhood had affected his success in business. That the way he saw the world and the way he did things kept him from success, and that he had found a teacher and he had learned and he was doing good. And I thought, whoa, I heard some things in childhood. So I talked to him and he encouraged me. And isn't it amazing? Within 2 months, I had the name of a teacher in the States. I had a phone number, I had a tape, and I had some hope. And I called, and within 2 months, I was in the States. Don't you know all the smart ones are in the States? So I went to the States, and I learned about the subconscious. I learned that from the third trimester to 7 years of age. And, you know, if you think that this shouldn't be talked about in AA, read 12 and 12. Right in step 8, Bill says it. He got it. He knew it. And he at some point said that he always felt that he had to be number one. That was it. That's what he took on in childhood. What I took on in childhood was, I'm not important. I mean, after all, if I were important, you'd fix Dora. That was the criterion. I'm not important. Nobody sees me. Nobody cares about me. That's what I took on. And I learned how these old ideas stick in our subconscious. And we listen to them, and they become more real than the truth. Because by that time, I had degrees. I had important positions. I had money. I had all kinds of things. And I still felt like nothing. Like today, when I heard June, that's what got triggered in me. Nobody wants to hear me. You know, I don't know anything. I don't have a big dramatic story like she does and so on. You know, and I've done a lot of work. I really believe what step 3 says, that we have to be rid of those old ideas because it is the voice of the false self. And I can't listen to God and listen to the voice of the false self without there being some kind of conflict, some kind of difficulty in our lives. I'm not saying that's the work you have to do. That's the work I have had to do. And it's still, you know, as I think I did that work 28 years ago. And I do that kind of thing kind of religiously when, you know, the old voice comes up. And I still hear that sometimes. I'm not totally free of it. And somebody said to me one day, do you think we'll ever be free of the false self? Frankly, I don't. I don't think so. I think some of the great saints, they were the mystics, like Emily Dickinson, who could say this. She said, some of us see every bush of fire with God. The rest of us just pick blackberries. I think that's the deal. I think that's what our program offers us. You know, if you think you do the steps, what do you get? It never says you're going to get a big house. It doesn't say your relationships are going to be perfect. It doesn't say you're going to have a wonderful success. It says you're going to get a spiritual awakening. That's how St. Augustine could say, thou hast made us for thyself, O God, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. That's what the deal's about. See, and The problem for me was the old beliefs have given you habit patterns. You know, if you've ever tried to change something, you know that your behavior over 20 years comes back to haunt you. You're so used to doing, responding to things that way, that it's very difficult to say, I'm going to do this different. And so, as I started to try to apply what I had learned at this event, you know, and look what Bill says. He says, we've had experiences buried below the level of consciousness. At the time of these occurrences, they have given our emotions violent twists that have since discolored our personalities and altered our lives for the worse. I believe that. I didn't know that. I thought you were the problem. I thought my mother was the problem. I thought the problem was out there. And now I find out it's these old beliefs. So that has become part of my growth. Step six then also became important to me in terms of my relationships with people. I began to realize something. And the big realization was, Father O'Brien, you mentioned your Father O'Brien, mine was another one, he was a Jesuit, and he right about this time, he called me, and he said, I want you to come and give a retreat. I said, Father, that's laughable. I said, I've been excommunicated. And he said, I don't care about that. He said, I want you to come and give a retreat. And so I went and gave a retreat, 70 women. I was finishing the retreat, the last talk, and I started to cry. I didn't like women at that point. Women represented competition. They represented, I considered I was weak. Men had the power. My crazy thinking, but that's the way I thought. And so, to cry in front of 70 women ain't gonna be happening, but it did. And I stood there bawling. And out of my mouth came something I thought I would never say. I said, I don't have a friend in the world. I have lots of acquaintances, but I don't have a friend in the world. Why? Because I'm different. Nobody cares about me. I told you about chasing the little girls running away from me. And I had never. And I was so hell-bent on trying to get you to like me so that I wouldn't feel so miserable that I put up walls. I let you see what I determined you were going to see. You could see how smart I was. Could you see how broken I was? Not a chance. And there I was exposing it all. I said it all. I don't have a friend in the world. And that's when step six started to change for me. Because those women stepped up. After I finished, they came up and said, come on, let's have coffee. I didn't know how to do some very simple things. I knew how to teach people. I've got the information. You're the one that needs it. I know how to do that. But for you and I to sit as equals and for me to treat you like that, the way I treat you, I didn't know how to do that. That was the start of the change. Because that's really what I think step six is about. It's not just saying, this is wrong with me, that's wrong with me, etc. What are the steps I'm going to take to change that? And that's where the difficulty comes in. And that's where the yammering of the false self is the loudest. That, to me, is what the work is. To understand what that voice is. Like today, when I came out of here shaking, I knew what the voice was saying. You're nothing. You're not important. You're not like her. See, I've learned something else about this business. It's very important to be open to what people will tell me. I didn't used to let people, because I had those walls up. You knew better than to say things to me. You know, Bob has talked about that when you do a fourth step. And, you know, if people were to come and tell you the truth, you might see things very different. I had never allowed that. And things were starting to change. People would tell me certain things I had done or things I had said. And that's how step six started to come alive in me. I didn't say it at the time, but I think that on May the 20th, 1973, God or the angels or whoever pays attention to this must have said, "Good stuff. At last she's got it. She knows that she doesn't know how to run the world. Now we can teach her." And that's exactly what has happened. I have been taught every day. So, and I've talked with my sponsor and my mentors about this. God let me run free that first 21 years because I wasn't ready to do prayer and meditation and those changes. And I needed to learn how to live. I did. I became a very good businesswoman. I became a very decent businesswoman. I learned how to handle things. And it enabled me as I moved on, you see. As I said, you know, when I was sober 18, that just knocked me for a loop. I've got to make a decision. Either God is everything or nothing. And you know something? I have to make that decision every day. Do I really believe that God is everything or God is nothing? That is, to me, what prepares me for 8 and 9. It prepares me for step 10, where it says we're supposed to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And then that prepares us for step 11, where it says we pray only for knowledge of His will for us. Not how am I going to get my will done anymore, but knowledge of what is it that is happening here that I can cooperate with. So, things started to change. I've always seen this. When the earth has moved for me, I always get the information I need. And the piece of information that came my way at this point was page 55. Deep within. You know, isn't it amazing how you can read things in the book and gloss over them and they don't mean anything, and one day, bingo! It says there, deep within, every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It is only there that he may be found. What in the name of heaven would that mean? And then somebody gave me this little the note from between Einstein and Gandhi, because Gandhi used to put out this message, Namaste. And Einstein said, "What does that mean?" He said, "It means the God in me salutes the God in you." Now, if I'm going to go about the world trying to be more loving, more kind, I'm going to see that power. It's a great piece of information to know that I don't have to like the outside of you. Nobody ever said I have to agree with everything that anybody does, but what I have to do is honor the God in you. You think about what's going on. I remember Chuck Chamberlain saying something to me, and it's in one of his tapes. He said to me, you know, I think that we're doing, this would have been about 1965, maybe, 1964. He was giving a talk, and he said, I believe we're doing a good job carrying the message to the suffering alcoholic. But he said, I think that maybe our real purpose is to bring God back into the world. Think about today. Where is God? Not G-O-D of the church, but where is love and goodness practiced unconditionally? I don't know a place where it's practiced as diligently as it is if we are living our AA program. So that meant a great deal to me. It changed me substantially. This idea that instead of looking at you and judging you, I don't like your behavior, I don't like the way you... Like, the energy I was putting out was pretty negative. And I started putting out a different energy. You know, somebody taught me this, that what we have going on inside is the energy that we put out. And your energy reads my energy. You ever had this happen? Where you meet somebody and they're all smiles, but you know something isn't right. I used to do that. I could hate your guts. But if it were to my advantage, I could smile like nobody's business. See, and that's why I think it's so important that we grab these. It has been for me, I'm not telling you, it has been really crucial for me to grab this and practice this so that the energy I'm putting out is the energy of good. How are we going to change the world? Not by changing laws. Changing laws is important, I realize that. But if we don't change the energy between us, how's that going to happen? So that was a really big... important thing that happened to me, to be careful of the energy, the thinking I have within. And that's when I began to realize how negative my thinking had been. You know, and the other day before I left Toronto, I was talking to a friend of mine. She's studying at Berkeley, and she said, I love that you're going to give this retreat and so on. And she said, you know, one of the professors at Berkeley had just been talking about happiness. This is Berkeley. And she said he was talking about the fact of oneness. And he said that he felt that if we do not recognize the divine, he didn't say God. He meant he was talking about a power bigger than all of us that accompanies us. And a lot of the scientists are talking about this, that we're one. And he said, we need to understand that there is the divine that encompasses all of us. So that helped me a great deal. At this time also, I had... been reading something from the Dalai Lama. And one of the things they asked him was, what is your religion? And he said, my religion is kindness. Kindness. And I adopted that. And I realized how many times I had been harsh with people. I realized how many times the phone would ring, and if it didn't suit me, I didn't answer it. I realized how many times, instead of being kind and considerate and all of that, I had been harsh to somebody, or I had spoken, told them a truth maybe they shouldn't hear at that time, that they needed some time to grow into it. So I have made that one of my disciplines, and I call it a discipline because I don't always want to be kind. Because to be kind, I've got to get at that old stuff that dwells within, the old beliefs. I don't like you, and I don't like the way you talked, and I don't like this, and yeah. And one of the last ones that has been really powerful with me is the business of love. I look around, and there are three little dogs. And I love every one of them. Take them all three home. And four babies. I won't be quite so generous with them. But it strikes me, everything I've been reading, everything I've been hearing, God is love. We are made out of love. And then I read this. I love when people give me strategies. It's one thing to say, I understand this, but then how do you put it into practice? And then I read this, and this author said, you know, there are so many people feel unloved today, and always have, because they're waiting for somebody to give them love. And he said, don't wait for somebody to give you love. You give them love. And he said, who's the rich one? If I have $1 million and I give you $1 million, who's the rich one? Is it you or me? Of course it's me. I'm the one that had it to give. And if I'm the one that has it to give, then I am the one filled with love. It's an amazing thing that happens. So instead of being harsh with somebody, instead of feeling the world has passed me by, or whatever that old negative stuff that dwells in the subconscious is, I can be kind. I can be loving. And I tell you, that has changed everything in my life. You know, don't know if I want to tell you this, but I think I will. In the interest of being transparent, I had an interesting experience. I come from a family of 10. You would think, wouldn't you, that, and I was petted. I did not ever lack for anything. The only thing they didn't give me, they didn't fix Dora. And if you didn't fix Dora, you're out. Dora, in case you don't know, was our sister who had been injured at birth. And she cried a lot because they kept her in grade 3 till she was 16, and her peers made fun of her. And I wanted it fixed. That was my big thrust. And if you worked on that with me, I loved you. And if you didn't, see you later, bud. So, and I grew up really as the baby of a big family. I grew up really as an only child. And I have to tell you, I realize this now. That family, that big family, they were all older. And they had a different life than I did. My father was a big farmer and a big rich farmer. And that's what they had. Me, I'm 5 years old. How do I fit in with that? I don't fit. And I grew up feeling very alone. And I have to tell you, I had an experience. And I'm going to be 90 soon. And that's good. Ooh, ooh, yeah. Very good. I had an experience not too long ago that I had never had in my life. Big difference between saying I love you and really feeling what that really means. And I'll tell you, this is as genuine as I can be. I have a sponsee who has a son who just got a little dog. So one Sunday, they invited me over to meet the dog. And I'm sitting on the couch, and this little guy was about this size, just a big fist at that time, white, beautiful, white, soft hair. And they put him on my knee. And then he kind of slipped off my knee, and we were sitting there. And as the conversation went on, I realized what I was feeling. This may mean nothing to you. It means everything to me. I felt love. I felt oneness. Not said it. I felt it. It was beautiful. It was glorious. As I petted that little guy, and they had been talking about somebody who was going to maybe spend on another dog $15,000 to keep it alive for 6 months. And I looked at him and I said, Gigi, if you needed $15,000 to stay alive for 6 months, I'd give that for you. I love that dog. And I think about that experience when I meditate. And I thought about that experience when I came from Jane's talk and I was shaking. And I thought, that's the way you love me, God. You're not asking me to do this or that or anything. You just wish to pour your love on me. And isn't it wonderful how God puts these experiences into your life that help you to grow? That's what I think the deal of 6 and 7 is really about, where we get to do that. I don't have to, like in 7, he says, look at the 7 deadly sins. I don't like the 7 deadly sins, never have. Had too much fun practicing them. But I like to look at my experience. That little experience with the dog is precious to me. You see, and another person I want to mention is Father Thomas Keating. Father Thomas Keating shocks me. Father Thomas Keating was an abbot. He's gone now. He was the abbot of a Cistercian monastery in Snowmass, Colorado. And one of my mentors recommended that I check him out, and because he teaches centering prayer and thought this might be helpful to me, etc. So they sent me to some YouTubes that he had done and a book that he had written. To my utter amazement, the first part of the book is all about childhood. Here's this Cistercian monk, and he has studied this and talks about the stuff that's buried in the subconscious and how we need meditation to break it up. He kind of talks about it as if it has to get broken up and crystallized and eventually vanish. I couldn't believe it. And then when you listen to any of his YouTubes, he radiates love. It spills out of him. And you begin to see what, you know, and I'm not talking about a church God. I left that a long time ago. When I left the convent, I left the church God. And I'm not against church. Don't hear that. That's not, it just wasn't for me. And one of my friends was at a meeting one day. This is when Father Keating was still alive. And he said, we were sitting there. And he said, there was an electricity in the room. And he said, we looked around, and there he stood at the back. That's the power of this grace. I learned to listen to my soul. That's why I listened this noon when I said, I love Jane, but I'm not Jane. I've got my own experience of life. But he just, even on YouTube, you just get it. He just drips love. And I just think, if I can do nothing more than that, I will have not lived in vain to have come from where I've come and to sit there with that little dog and just pet him and pet him. I'd still be sitting there petting him if I hadn't had to get on with the business of living. One more thing I'll talk a little bit about. Because this weekend has been very, very immersed in family and love and family and so on. And I've thought a lot about my position in life. I live alone, and my family, 8 of them are gone. I have one sister left, and she's in the West. And the circle of friends that I've had in Toronto, I've taken 60 names off my phone list. When you're healthy, you stay healthy. They're gone. And there's an aloneness that comes with that. Now, one of the things I'm grateful for is the program and the ability to work with young people and to make friends and all that kind of thing. But it doesn't take away the sense of aloneness. And, you know, I have really prayed about that because what I've learned to do is live in the moment, you know, and just look around and be grateful for what? Be grateful for the beautiful bed I have. Be grateful for the beautiful furniture. Be grateful for a fridge full of food. Be in the moment and eventually, I tell you one more thing that has come out of that. I realized something. I never knew this. And what I realized was this, that all my life, right from small on, and I didn't realize it, I always wanted to be somebody else, and I always wanted to be somewhere else. And it sounds like this. I would feel better if I were like that. Or, I remember packing once to go to Paris. And I remember distinctly the feeling I had. Why am I going to Paris? I don't want to be in Paris. But it was kind of, yeah, I should go to Paris and, you know, see some things and that will... And I thought, I didn't want to go to Paris. But what hit me was this, where do you want to be? And I had to realize there was no place I wanted to be because what I had done, I had grown up thinking, I'm not okay. I'm not okay as the person I am, and it's not okay here. That's the effect of some of that childhood stuff. So what I am practicing these days is being grateful for what it is that I have. Being grateful that I can be here, had the nerve to get up here and talk to you about this. To be grateful for the food that I have. Be grateful for the opportunities to grow and change and all the goodness that has come into my life. And I think that's probably all the useful things I have to say to you. God bless you for having me.